Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time lover of all Italian film.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that searches the globe for quality cinema, no matter the genre. This week, that genre is a blend, one being international, the other being fantasy. The international part is obvious, our first film, Universal Language, being from Canada, albeit with a Persian face. The second is totally Italian, Partenope, being a love letter to the city of Naples. As for the fantasy, well, neither is the type that features sorcery or elves or any other kind of popular fiction. Instead, Universal Language is a study of connection and disconnection with a strong surrealist overlay. Partenope, meanwhile, involves references to ancient Greek mythology. Let's begin by heading to a Canada that only those who can speak Farsi are apt to recognize. As directed by Matthew Rankin from a script that he co-wrote with Ila Farouzabadi and Piroz Nemati, Universal Language is a hybrid between contemporary Canada and 1980s, 1990s Iran. Rankin's screenwriting team tells three stories at once. One involves two sisters who discover a 500 riel bill, not actual currency, frozen in ice and want to retrieve it to buy a friend new glasses. Shades of Majid Majidi's 1997 film, Children of Heaven. Another follows a tour guide, played by co-screenwriter Nemati, who takes clients on a tour of Winnipeg's more obscure sites. And then we have Rankin himself, who plays a man moving from Montreal back to Winnipeg and attempting to reconnect with his mother. What makes Universal Language unique is tone, which flirts between a sense of melancholy amid sequences of humor. The melancholy mostly involves Rankin's character, but it also reflects his view of Winnipeg, a snow-laden city of gray and beige buildings. The humor involves the various signs and billboards, all in Farsi, and tour sites such as a shopping mall fountain that doesn't work and an abandoned briefcase that no one dares touch. Universal Language might not divulge any great secrets about life, except maybe how hard it is sometimes, but it just might keep you entertained and even invite you to chuckle to its very end.
And I was actually laughing to myself as you were describing some of those things, remembering them, because while watching Universal Language, I wasn't always laughing, although I did have some pretty big laughs here and there, but remembering just the absurdity of some of the images and scenarios, I'm like, that was actually pretty funny, wasn't it? This was Canada's submission for the Best International Feature Oscar, and it was not nominated, but I think I liked it more than a couple of the movies that actually ended up being nominated this year. And to sort of explain the concept a bit more, this almost exists in an alternate reality where Canadian culture and Iranian culture coexist. And so it would be easy to say that he's marrying the sensibilities of, say, Abbas Kiarostami, who's probably the most revered Iranian filmmaker, and Guy Maddin, who is the most revered director from Winnipeg, of course. And some people speak French, some people speak Farsi or Persian, and there are open-air markets, but there are also Tim Hortons, and the Tim Hortons serve chai tea and donuts. So it's a very absurdist movie, and it has this deadpan sense of humor and a lot of symmetrical framing. So the movie begins, and I think, oh, this looks like a Wes Anderson movie. Then as it goes on, there's all this kind of pressing bureaucracy. And I thought, oh, this is like a Roy Anderson movie. And I was thinking of Jim Jarmusch. I was thinking of Jacques Tati.
I was thinking of David Lynch, a very light David Lynch.
Yeah, there are shades of True Stories, the David Byrne film, which was itself a whimsical tour of strange people living in a town. That film has a woman who would not get out of bed. This movie has a woman who cannot stop crying. And so the townspeople play bingo to win her a lifetime supply of Kleenex. And I was also reminded of, and this is a reference that will get somebody out there to go see this movie. It is a very specialized reference. But the movie Universal Language reminded me of the filmed sketches of The Kids in the Hall, which were often set in these grim, gray, industrial parts of Canada. And it always seemed like it was below freezing no matter where they went. So if all of those things sound appealing to you, this movie, Universal Language, probably will be too. And I know that those are a lot of comparisons to other very distinctive filmmakers' works. And at first I thought this felt more like a tribute act than an original movie. But Rankin, the director, reveals his own sensibility as the movie goes on. And the last 15 to 20 minutes are disarmingly mournful and strange in a whole different way. And so at first I thought, I think this movie is going to be kind of a one-trick pony. And it just kept winning me back over. Every time I thought I was out, they pulled me back in, to quote.
And you didn't even mention the turkeys.
Well,
turkeys,
I mean,
all the way through.
The turkeys are running roughshod over this town, let me tell you. But they're
like some other towns.
I guess that's true. Maybe it's more like the South Hill than we like to think. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by this movie because I didn't know what to expect, and I wasn't sure if it was going to click for me, and it really clicked for me.
I agree, because when it started out, I couldn't even figure out what direction. So these two men are going back to Winnipeg from Montreal, but I didn't even understand the course of their journey at first. And I finally figured it out, and that's when the turkey's primary cameo appeared.
Yes.
Because he's a prize turkey who is also on the bus going to Montreal next to a woman whose life is already in.
And she's mad that she has to sit next to a turkey, and the bus driver says, hey, he bought a ticket.
Yeah, I know it. And she goes, yes, but the indignity. My son died of a marshmallow eating accident, and my husband was killed by a swarm of bees. It's like, what?
Yeah. I mean, so it is absurd in various parts, but I thought one of the highlights of this film was the cinematography, because they talk about these beige and gray buildings. As a matter of fact, some of the characters give directions to one another by talking about go down two gray buildings and turn left at the beige building. And we see all of that brutalist architecture in the film, which is sort of contrasted against sometimes this beautiful snow and sometimes the snow that's been there for like months and months. I also thought that, as you're saying, this tour of Winnipeg was so disarming. I mean, the things that they focus on, at one point they stop at the founder of the city, and the tour guide says
Manitoba.
And it says, you have to stay here for 30 minutes.
Of silence.
Right.
And they're in the middle of like crisscrossing freeways.
Yes.
And then at one point he says, you know, he was a revolutionary and he helped found Manitoba. And one of the guys in the tour group raises his hand and goes, what was his annual salary as a revolutionary?
Like, I mean,
that's funny.
We're making this sound like a laugh fest, and it isn't really a laugh fest, but it is funny.
Oh, yeah.
It is funny.
Well, and as you said, Nathan, the tone changes at various points throughout the film. But at that point, we bought in so much that we're willing to go with it. So when it sort of shifts from the more poignant aspects of these relationships, we're willing to go there with the film. And I think that for whatever reason, not a lot happens, but everything happens at the same time. And so I like that sort of energy that ranges from low-key and bizarre.
We always refer back at times to the Tennessee Williams, depending on the kindness of strangers. And Matthew, the character in this, does do that when he comes first to the house where his mother used to live. And he's embraced by these people who live there who don't even know him. And it's when you talk of poignancy, Mary Pat, that is a perfect example.
And then it switches back to this walking Christmas tree. This guy who's decorated like a Christmas tree, and he wanders in and out of the film.
Well, and I want to bring up the Christmas tree guy. I also want to bring up, you referenced the line where the woman's talking about all the comic ways in which people in her family have succumbed. And it was moments like that where I thought Universal Language was maybe laying on the quirk a bit too thick. There were scenes where I thought, oh God, is this just going to be this for 80 some minutes? Like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle it. And there's a scene early on in what they call a French immersion school. And it's a scene right out of the classroom scene at the beginning of Annie Hall, where it's the kids talking about what they're going to be when they grow up. And it's this stern little girl who says, I want to be a diplomat. And then there's a kid that's just dressed as Groucho Marx, you know, and he says, I want to be a comedian. And sometimes it feels like maybe they could have reined it in a bit, because it sometimes feels almost like suffocating in its cutesiness. But then this disarming, genuine sweetness comes in, and you think, oh, the title of this movie, Universal Language, it's not just a gimmick. It's not just, isn't it funny that these two cultures are coexisting? It's actually saying, isn't it amazing that that could possibly be a reality, and everyone just accepts it, and that's not really the joke?
Well, and
I
the
Tim Hortons sign in Farsi is kind of a funny thing, but eventually you're right. You do just sort of accept the world.
Well, and I think that these stories are separate, but they're connected. And then you start to
in
see
ways
what
you don't expect.
Right, exactly. That is what Universal Language, I think, one of the reasons I admired it, because it did pull these threads together, and I was like, oh, I didn't think you'd be able to make that happen. So I think we all appreciated Universal Language.
And I also appreciate a movie that pays special tribute to the great Canadian anthem, These Eyes by The Guess Who.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Burton Cummings.
Mentioned that specifically.
Yes, one of the great songs, and it is prominently featured in this film.
And if nothing else, if this draws people back to those great Iranian films of the 1980s and 1990s, The Circle, The White Balloon, Close Up, Children of Heaven, so many of those great films, you know, then we'll give Matthew Rankin any benefit of the doubt. At any rate, that was our discussion of the Canadian import Universal Language. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts at Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss Paolo Sorrentino's Ode to Beauty, Partenope. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss the offbeat Canadian film Universal Language. Let's now turn to another kind of international fantasy, this one courtesy of the Italian filmmaker Paolo Sorrentino. One thing about Sorrentino, he works hard to capture the Italian spirit, whether in his 2013 Oscar-winning extravaganza, The Great Beauty, the 2016 miniseries, The Young Pope, starring Jude Law, or his 2021 somber study of family relations, The Hand of God. Though Partenope borrows from the Greek legend of the siren who tried in vain to seduce Odysseus, it refers to a section also of the modern city of Naples that dates back millennia. It also refers to a young woman of the same name, played by Celeste Dalla Porta, whom we watch evolve from a young beauty and emerge following a string of family tragedies and romantic liaisons as a mature professor of anthropology. The tie between Partenope the woman and Partenope as a symbol of Naples may not connect quite as smoothly for an American audience as it might for Italians, but for some of us, just looking at Dalla Porta is a reward enough, and for others of us, listening to the rich Italian language is always a joy.
I'm going to give a disclaimer at the beginning of my comments about Partenope, because I may be one of the few people in the world who loved this movie, and I loved it for a variety of reasons. Yep. Okay. And I'm going to make my case for Partenope. First of all, I like Paolo Sorrentino's movies. I mean, he puts it out there, and you may not agree with the choices that he makes, but I think he's willing to go bold and audacious, and he certainly does in various parts of this movie. It's beautiful. I mean, Dalla Porta is absolutely gorgeous. Keep in mind, and I think this has been a criticism of this film, that it's misogynist and it focuses on the male gaze and so forth. Please keep in mind that the time period of this film begins in the 1970s. So it's 1973. And our protagonist, Partenope, is more or less my age. And since I was a great beauty back in the day and ultimately became
an academic,
you still are, sweetheart. Of course I related to it. No, I mean, so it's beautifully filmed. Naples looks gorgeous. All of these shots by the sea are beautiful. And most important to my way of thinking, you know, I was very disappointed in The Room Next Door, the Almodovar film, because I kept waiting for Almodovar to, like, take it in a direction that he's noted for, which is to do something absurdist, to do something bizarre. And here there's one scene that I won't reveal too much. The Partenope character, who is pursued by men throughout the course of, you know, 25 years, is also the best anthropology student at the university. And she finds a mentor, and we find out that he has a child who has special circumstances. And so I won't say too much more because I want it to be a surprise. But she also, at one point, and I wasn't sure this really worked, she encounters John Cheever, who's visiting Italy and is portrayed by Gary Oldman. And so that's another bizarro thing that happened. So I want to be clear, this is not a film for everyone. But as Dan said, if you appreciate beauty, if you appreciate bizarre plot lines.
La lingua italiana.
See, if you can connect to the sort of vagaries of the academic process, then maybe you will like it. But I don't know what my co-reviewers thought, although each of them is making a strange face as I'm saying this.
Go ahead, Nathan.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I thought this stunk.
But you're not a big friend of Sorrentino anyway.
No. I find his movies to always be beguiling to look at, and I always feel adrift in them. I find them so mannered and empty. And I think when we reviewed his movie, The Hand of God, which I also thought was very bad, I described him as Fellini without any warmth, because he wants to have this sense of playfulness, this sense of eroticism and sensuality. And he also wants to make some kind of commentary about that, like you said, about objectification or the male gaze. I don't know what he's trying to say, though, because it's lost in this kind of aimless, picaresque story where she's going from one colorful character to another. This is basically Emmanuel, but with like a PhD or something, you know, like, and she's supposedly this great anthropology student, but I never bought that because he never gives her anything intelligent to say. And I will talk about some of the things I did like about Partenope, because he can't make a film that doesn't have something in it that makes you go, that's interesting, or that's clever. But I was reminded of this might seem like a stretch, but bear with me. The 1954 Joseph Mankiewicz movie, The Barefoot Contessa, which is also set in Italy. It's also a bunch of men who are beguiled by this woman played by Ava Gardner, and they have their lives changed by her, and they essentially anoint her because of how she's affected them, but they never really understand her. And the movie doesn't really either. And I felt like that was the problem with Partenope, is that I think he just gets lost in all of these quirky things he wants to throw in. I agree with you. Gary Oldman is John Cheever. I don't know what that's doing in there. The reveal of what's behind that professor's closed door, it's like something out of Bo is Afraid. I was like totally – I almost wish the movie had been that kind of weird all the way through. You know what I mean? So, yeah, this just didn't work for me at all. But I guess with the caveat that I don't particularly like the sensibility of this filmmaker most of the time.
And I think that he is an Italian filmmaker, even though you called him Fellini light. I mean, he introduces all these themes about beauty and the sort of connection between the influence of religion and sort of, you know,
the sacred and the profane and the
right, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, it may not work for everyone. So, yeah. Dan,
well, I don't want to yuck anyone's yum.
No. I'm in between the two of you because I really like the point you made about this feeling like some sort of a picaresque fantasy, because it did feel to me like he was just passing time, you know, and that there was no real structure to what was going on. But it would always come back to, I appreciate his films much more than you do, Nathan, simply because I like looking at them. I like looking what he puts on the screen. And it is beautiful. And it is, she is stunning. Yeah. And I love listening to Italian. I can just sit there and close my eyes and it would entertain me. So I'm in between the two of you. I didn't love Partenope. There are so many better Italian films, but I didn't think it stank.
Here's the thing. It felt endless to me. Like, this movie is 2 hours and maybe 10 minutes, and it felt twice as long. And honestly, like, the fact that it is so beautifully made and the fact that it does have shots that made me go, wow, look at that shot, almost made the fact that everything about the story and the characters being so empty, it almost made it worse because of the chasm between the qualities there.
Yeah, the other thing that I would mention, and maybe Mary Pat, you can talk about this a little bit, is that for us American audiences, this movie is a movie that will speak much more to an Italian audience because they might understand his references to Partenope and that part of Naples, which it symbolized.
You can say the same thing about Canadian audiences with universal language.
Exactly,
there's probably a lot of in-jokes here that sailed over my head.
Yep. Well, and as I said, this film it starts in 1950 when our protagonist is born, and it continues to the present day. And the fact that it sort of traverses all of this territory, maybe it was an overreach, so to speak. But we do see some things that happen in the background during these changes from period to period. And we also see that, you know, Naples has always been viewed as a grittier southern city compared to cities in the north, for example. And I think that in the past few years, it has really caught the eye of a number of travel writers and so forth, because it's strikingly beautiful. And I think that he is able to sort of capture some of these tensions among what's happening over these time periods in a way that I found to be interesting. But again, I am biased because I liked this film ends with the Professor Della Porta's retirement party. Mm. And so I guess that spoke to me in some interesting way.
Sure. You didn't even mention that the last time we were in Naples, we stayed in a hotel with a great view of the Bay of Naples. And for the first time, I thought, wow, this city is beautiful. Because before that, we'd been stuck in places that just felt gritty and, you know.
And a bit of travel advice, do not take the ferry from Naples to the Lipari Islands, because that was not the most pleasant trip.
Yeah. I do have to say there is one scene in Partenope that I did really like. And it has all of these kind of almost like one scene cameo characters throughout it. And it's this actress who has left Naples, gone off to be famous, and she's finally back again. And she's there for the dedication of this sculpture that is supposedly inspired by her. And they drop the shroud that's covering it, and it's like a couple of pieces of metal. Like, it's very abstract. And she looks at it, and you can tell that she hates it. And then she turns around and just tells everyone in the audience, after graciously welcoming them, how disgusting Naples is and how she's glad she got out of there. And so there are moments like that where I thought, you know, if it had been maybe more in that kind of tone, I might have responded to it more. But as such, like Dan said, there are lots of other Italian movies you could watch. But
yeah, beginning with some Fellini ones.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway, that was our discussion of the Italian film Partenope, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed the Canadian feature Universal Language. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you, too, our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words about Leonardo DiCaprio's character of Cliff in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Foreign films, Cliff thought, were more like novels. They didn't care if you liked the main character or not. And Cliff found that intriguing. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.